Good morning.
Good morning.
Can we turn to Job? I'm going to start with chapter 34 today. Job chapter 34, and that's going to be on page 819 of the Chapel Bible. We're going to read chapter 34 and chapter 35. Job chapter 34. Elihu further answered and said, "Hear my words, you wise men. Give ear to me, you who have knowledge. For the ear tests words as the palate tastes food. Let us choose justice for ourselves. Let us know among ourselves what is good. For Job has said, 'I am righteous, but God has taken away my justice. Should I lie concerning my right? My wound is incurable, though I am without transgression.' What man is like Job, who drinks scorn like water, who goes in company with the workers of iniquity and walks with wicked men? For he has said, 'It profits a man nothing that he should delight in God.' Therefore, listen to me, you men of understanding. Far be it from God to do wickedness, and from the Almighty to commit iniquity. For he repays man according to his work, and makes man to find a reward according to his way. Surely God will never do wickedly, nor will the Almighty pervert justice. Who gave him charge over the earth? Or who appointed him over the whole world? If he should set his heart on it, if he should gather to himself his spirit and his breath, all flesh would perish together, and man would return to dust. If you have understanding, hear this. Listen to the sound of my words. Should one who hates justice govern? Will you condemn him who is most just? Is it fitting to say to a king, 'You are worthless,' and to nobles, 'You are wicked'? Yet he is not partial to princes, nor does he regard the rich more than the poor, for they are all the work of his hands. In a moment they die, in the middle of the night. The people are shaken and pass away. The mighty are taken away without a hand. For his eyes are on the ways of man, and he sees all his steps. There is no darkness nor shadow of death where the workers of iniquity may hide themselves. For he need not further consider a man that he should go before God in judgment. He breaks in pieces mighty men without inquiry and sets others in their place. Therefore, he knows their works. He overthrows them in the night, and they are crushed. He strikes them as wicked men in the open sight of others, because they turned back from him and would not consider any of his ways, so that they cause the cry of the poor to come to him, for he hears the cry of the afflicted. When he gives quietness, who then can make trouble? And when he hides his face, who then can see him? Whether it is against the nation or a man alone, that the hypocrite should not reign, lest the people be ensnared. For has anyone said to God, 'I have borne chastening, I will offend no more. Teach me what I do not see. If I have done iniquity, I will do no more'? Should he repay it according to your terms, just because you disavow it? You must choose, and not I. Therefore speak what you know. Men of understanding, say to me, wise men who listen to me, 'Job speaks without knowledge. His words are without wisdom.' Oh, that Job were tried to the utmost, because his answers are like those of wicked men. For he adds rebellion to his sin. He claps his hands among us and multiplies his words against God." Moreover, Elihu answered and said, "Do you think this is right? Do you say, 'My righteousness is more than God's'? For you say, 'What advantage will it be to you? What profit shall I have more than if I had sinned?' I will answer you and your companions with you. Look to the heavens and see, and behold the clouds. They are higher than you. If you sin, what do you accomplish against him? Or if your transgressions are multiplied, what do you do to him? If you are righteous, what do you give him? Or what does he receive from your hand? Your wickedness affects a man such as you, and your righteousness a son of man. Because of the multitude of oppressions they cry out. They cry out for help because of the arm of the mighty. But no one says, 'Where is God my maker, who gives songs in the night, who teaches us more than the beasts of the earth, and makes us wiser than the birds of heaven?' There they cry out, but he does not answer, because of the pride of evil men. Surely God will not listen to empty talk, nor will the Almighty regard it. Although you say you do not see him, yet justice is before him, and you must wait for him. And now, because he has not punished in his anger, nor taken much notice of folly, therefore Job opens his mouth in vain. He multiplies words without knowledge." Last time we were introduced to Elihu, he's a young man. He had evidently been listening to the conversation that was taking place. He had heard the arguments of the three friends. He had heard everything that Job had said, and it said his anger was kindled. He was very upset with the way both sides were talking, and he had waited patiently, and he finally had an opportunity, and so now he speaks. And we saw that Elihu already was very different in his approach to Job. He was coming, his intention wasn't to hurt Job, his intention wasn't to make him feel the way his friends had made him feel. His intention was to have a conversation, and he told Job repeatedly, "Talk, answer me back. I wanna have this conversation with you." And we even saw that Elihu, he talked, and in his opening remarks, we saw pictures of Christ, which we didn't see any of his friends. We haven't seen any pictures of Christ offered from their dialogues, and so we already see this is a different person than Job's friends. He's coming from a different perspective. And so when you just read it from when you're reading it and you're not really looking in depth, you're just sort of getting that really, you're not paying full attention. He sounds very similar in these two chapters that we read. He kind of sounds very similar to Job's friends. He's upset. There is some emotion here that he's sharing, and he's saying some very difficult things to Job, but we have to see that he's not talking the same way Job's friends were talking. Because if you remember, his friends were very critical of Job because he was suffering. So his friends, they saw what Job had gone through. They saw the suffering. They saw he lost everything. They saw what he looked like. And their assumption was he must have done something wrong because he's suffering. Elihu is very upset with Job because how Job responded to his suffering. And so Elihu has heard all the things that Job has had to say, and he's upset with what Job has said. He's not really looking backward. He's not saying, you deserve this because of this, this happened, you must have done something wrong. He's saying, the things you're saying right now are not, it doesn't reflect on who God really is. You're saying things that are not right. And that's where he's really upset. And as we see, it's important to know that they're coming from a different perspective. That Elihu, his intention's not to accuse Job of sin. His intention is to correct what Job has said about God after all of these things have fallen on him. And so from the very first part, the first four verses of chapter 34, he's giving that appeal to have this open invitation to listen, to choose what's right together. He's saying, let us choose justice. Let us know among ourselves what is good. He wants this to be from both sides, that it's not just, let me tell you what's right. Let me tell you what justice really is. Let me do this. No, let us do this together. Let's find out what's right. And let's pursue justice. Let's pursue reality. And let's pursue the truth. And so he wants that for everyone there. And then in verses 5 to 9, he's sort of quoting Job. And he said, Job has said, I'm righteous, but God has taken away my justice. Should I lie concerning my right? My wound is incurable, though I am without transgression. And you see that Job had this idea that he was entitled to be blessed because of his actions. That my right, he throws that in. It was I was entitled. This was my right. So he's upset that he had this idea that because of the way he was living, there should have been blessing. And there should have been prosperity. And there shouldn't have been. This shouldn't have happened. And Elihu's sort of pointing that out to him. And reality is, we're not entitled to anything in this world. And we'll see that as we go through. There's not one thing on earth that I can claim for myself that I deserve it. We didn't even pick our name when we were born. We're entitled to anything. And it's just, he's pointing that out. And then in verses 7 through 9, he says Job is just full of scorn and contempt. He says, it's like you're drinking it. It's like you've saturated yourself with scorn. You're so full of scorn. Job's saying that it seems like it's pointless to serve God. In verse 9, he said, it profits a man nothing that he should delight in God. And Job did say before, he said, when he was talking to his friends, he said, what I'm about to say, I'm uncomfortable saying. He said, and you might put your hands over your mouth, it might shock you, but it seems like the wicked prosper. And it seems like it doesn't make sense. It seems like sometimes the wicked do okay in the world. And what's the point if that's happening? So there is that sort of he did have sort of these weird, he's just so confused about the circumstances, and he's suffering and he's in pain and he's trying to make sense of things. And he did say, you know, it doesn't profit either way. And so Elihu's pointing that out, that that's not the right way to think. That it's not, we can't just be full of contempt because of our situations, that we're full of scorn and bitterness and anger and he's upset, but that's not the right attitude. And he says in verses 10 through 12, this is really important, because he's saying, far be it from God to do wickedness and from the Almighty to commit iniquity. So he's sort of reestablishing the baseline, right? So when something terrible happens, when we suffer, when our world gets shaken, we have to hold on to those absolute objective truths that will always be true no matter what. And so one of those truths is that God cannot do wickedness. God cannot commit iniquity. God is perfect and sinless and holy. And when my brother passed away, my sister, she at one point she was just so unsure. She's like, she was so unsure of everything. She's like, nothing makes sense anymore. And my brother-in-law said, no, they sat down together and they said, what do we know about God? What do we know about the Lord? Let's look in here. What objective truths do I know about him that I can cling to? Even though the world around me doesn't seem to make sense right now, and the things I'm feeling and the things I'm going through seem to contradict what I know. But don't rely on your subjective knowledge. You have to have that objective knowledge, that there are truths outside of myself and outside of my circumstances that I can hold on to. And one of those is, God cannot commit wickedness. He cannot commit iniquity. And he's that one that I can trust. He's that holy, righteous God. And I also know he loves me. No matter what, his love for me will never change. And so I can cling to that in those times as well. And so we need to just make sure, it's so hard to do, because your whole world is shaking. It's like you're in a boat in a storm. Everything is all over. The waves are coming. There seems like there's no stability, but we need to just remember those things that are outside of us, outside of our circle of experience, and just cling to God and the truths of God that we know from the Word of God. And then, as we go, he says in verses 13 through 15, he says, who gave him charge over the earth? Who appointed him over the whole world? So God is above everything. No one put God in authority. No one gave God authority. He has it in and of himself because of who he is, because he's the source of all life. He's the source of all existence. And so he has this intrinsic authority, and he has absolute control over life. You see that in verses 14 and 15. He says, if God wanted to, he could just gather all life, all the spirit of that's in man, and he could just take it all away from us, and then we would die. We would all just be dust, if he wanted to. So he's that source of life. How can we, as humans, come to God in an accusatory way, knowing this, that he's the one who is above all? No one gave him authority. He has it in and of himself, and he sustains life. He's the creator and sustainer of life. And so how can I come in that way, with that arrogance, to even come before him in any sort of way to accuse him or question his motives or what he's doing? And then as we go, as we go through 16 to 20, he says it's not right. He talks about, you know, you can't really talk back to a king. You can't talk back to a prince, someone who's in, you know, a government authority over you. It's not appropriate to tell a king that you're worthless, or to tell a noble person that they're wicked. You're risking your life if you do that. You don't have the position to say that. And he said, God is not partial to princes. He's above them. He's above those authorities. We can't talk to the president of the United States any way we want. You could get in serious trouble. I can't. How then could I talk to God who's above him? And it's just so you know, God doesn't regard kings and rulers, so we need to just have that in mind. And he just talks that, you know, they're all the work of his hands. Even these ones, these rich men of power and the poor person on the street, they're all the work of his hands. And so we show favoritism sometimes to different people, or we show different levels of respect because of how we perceive those people. God isn't that way. God is so far above that. And so we can't just approach him in any way. And so Elihu's just trying to show how lofty, how far above us God is. And it's really humbling as you read this, just to think that the one who created us, the one who sustains us, the one who has absolute power over all life, and the one who doesn't care whether you live in a palace or you live on the street, that one is the one who's in control. And that one is the one that, like I said before, he loves us and he's in control. And what can we say to that? When the circumstances aren't the way we want them to be, what am I supposed to say to that? Do I have any right to come before God, the maker of heaven and earth, the one who sustains life with his word? Say, why did you do it this way? I think you did it wrong. We have no position to accuse God. And then, as we go in 21 through 28, he talks about how God's eyes see everything. And so when God comes in judgment, or when God, when he does things, he doesn't have to inquire first. He doesn't have to hold a tribunal. He doesn't have to hold a court session to investigate and figure out exactly what happened and exactly who this person is and exactly what this person did. He knows it already because he sees everything. And so God has, he's omniscient. We see his omnipotence before. We see his omniscience. You see how powerful this God is. And that he doesn't need to, he's the absolute judge over all the earth. And then it says in verses 29 and 30, when he gives quietness, who can make trouble? When he hides his face, who can see him? So when God makes a decision, we can't counteract that decision. When God does something, no one's going to prevent him from doing it. So if God gives someone quietness, no one's going to be able to give that person trouble if God has given them quietness. If God, and so we can't question his decisions. And it's just, and then he says in verses 31 and 32, has anyone said to God, and he's sort of implying that Job, we could look at Job in this, that I've borne chastening, I will offend no more. Teach me what I do not see. If I have done iniquity, I will do no more. Should he repay it according to your terms? And so has anyone approached the suffering and the suffering that God has given with humility and with acceptance? And then he says, but at the same time, in verse 33, should God work according to your terms just because you reject his terms? So in verse 33, should he repay it just because you're unhappy with the way he's done it? Should he do it differently for you? Is God going to work according to your terms? That's not how life works. That's not how God works. God is so far above us. And then in verses 34 through 37, he's saying that Job is speaking without knowledge. This is a challenging one. You say in verse 36, he says, oh, that Job were tried to the utmost, because his answers are like those of wicked men. You say, Elijah, that's really hard. That's a harsh thing to say. But he said, I want God to finish his work that he's doing in you. I want him to complete it, because the way you're acting, the things you're saying right now are like those things wicked men would say. God's doing something, and I want him to finish it. And the answer is, he's saying, there's rebellion in you, Job. You're adding rebellion to your sin. There's a rebellious spirit, because you're not accepting what God has done with humility and just trusting in him. And it's so challenging, but that's where we need to be. When we come into these circumstances that are so far above us, so far beyond us, we don't understand. We can just trust God and with humility just fall before God and just give it to him. We don't know better than him. And that's a hard lesson to learn. We don't know better than God. And then as he goes forward, he says in verses 1 and 2, do you think it's right? Do you say my righteousness is more than God's? How can we say that we're more righteous than God, who is the Holy One, the righteous one, the one who we understand righteousness because he's the source of righteousness. And how can we question the benefit? What benefit is it if I'm righteous? That's what he was going through. He was saying, it just seems like there was no point to me living for God. I've lost everything. What was the point of it all? I don't understand. And so as he's going into chapter 35, he's really talking about what our actions don't touch God. So he talks about, verses 4-8, if you're evil or if you're good, nothing you do can touch him. Your righteousness or your evil can affect a human alongside you. That the works you do, we can affect the person next door to us. We can impact our family or our friends with our actions. But God is so far above you that nothing you do touches him in that way. When you're righteous, it's not like he owes you a favor. When you're evil, it's not like you've hurt him personally. Now, we know that our actions, that God is either pleased or displeased. But it's the idea of if someone does something good for me, that I feel obligated to do good for them, and vice versa. That God doesn't operate on our human terms because he's not a person like you or me. And so Elihu's sort of drawing that out, that, if you're righteous, what are you giving to him? Or your wickedness might affect a man, but if your transgressions are multiplied, what are you doing to him? Is it really affecting God the way it would affect a human next to you? And then when God acts, it's not because we've directly impacted him for good or bad. And so that's what we have to keep that in mind as well. And that was also his friends. This was their thought, that because he had sinned, God had to act and pay him for that sin with punishment. That's not how God is. And then verses 9 through 13, we see that there's this picture of men crying out in verse 9. Because of the multitudes of oppressions, they cry out for help. And in verse 9, they're crying for relief from the pain. And that's what often happens. When something terrible happens, when there's suffering, when there's grief, when there's pain, when there's trial, most of the time it's, God, take this away. I can't handle this. Remove this, please. Do something. This is too much. And oftentimes that's how we respond initially, is just, I want relief from whatever this is. I can't bear this. But as he goes through, he says, no one says, where is God my maker, who gives songs in the night, who teaches us more than the beasts of the earth and makes us wiser than the birds of heaven? And it's not a real dependence. So often when men in suffering, men who are oppressed, are crying out to God, they're not crying out in dependence. They just want relief. And so they just want it to stop. Make it stop. Make it stop, please. This is too much. And they're not asking for songs in the night. They're not asking for those moments where they can sing to God in the dark times. They're not asking for wisdom. They're not asking to learn from this. And that's the difference. It says he gives songs in the night. It says he teaches us more than the beasts of the earth. How many songs do we have about how his eye is on the sparrow, I know that he will care for me? Or how many songs, you read the Psalms of men who are distressed, of people who are suffering, and yet they find that in those circumstances they can praise the Lord. The Lord gives us songs in the night. And then he gives us wisdom. He teaches us in the circumstances. There are lessons to be learned that he can teach us. You don't want to learn the lessons when you're suffering. You wish there was another way. You don't want to have to learn through the dark and difficult times. You wish you could have just known it already. But sometimes there are difficult lessons we have to learn. And then because of that, because these men who cry out for relief, they're not really dependent, oftentimes he doesn't answer. There's not a genuine cry to the Lord. It's just they're crying because they feel like there's nothing left and they want relief. And so sometimes there's no answer. And then as we look in verses 14 through 16, he says that although you say you do not see him, yet justice is before him and you must wait for him. And now, because he has not punished in his anger nor taken much notice of folly, therefore Job opens his mouth in vain and he multiplies words without knowledge. And so he's saying, you said you couldn't see him. You said you couldn't see him. He is just. And he's telling him to wait. Wait for him. You must wait for him. Justice is before him. God is just. Wait for him. And so that's, we have that in verse 14. And he says, he has not punished in his anger. And you've spoken in vain. You weren't thinking. The things you said, you weren't thinking. That God is a God of justice. God is righteous. You can trust him. Wait for him. Wait for him. And it's just, we did have when Job said, I look forward, I can't see him. I look to the left, I look to the right, I don't see him. And it's just sometimes the circumstances are so difficult. It seems like God isn't, you don't know where God is. God's there, wait. And God is righteous, and he knows what he's doing. And the lesson for us is, in the circumstances, we need to remember that baseline. Remember those objective truths we know about God. That's what we have to cling to. We can't let our circumstances change our knowledge of the truth. And that's why it's so important to know this. Because in the difficult times, it's not easy to remember the truths. It's not easy to search for the truths when you're suffering. Sometimes, the only thing you remember is that Jesus loves me, this I know. That's all you have. And that's all you can cling to, but that's, cling to it. Cling to those objective truths you know in the difficult times. And remember that God is righteous. Remember that God is love. Remember that he cares for you. Remember that you can wait for him. You can trust him. Remember he's got all authority. He has all power. He's in control. And I don't have a place to question what he's doing. But I can trust him that he knows what he's doing. Maybe just be encouraged. Amen.